Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This week on Meatin' 3, we're exploring the culinary wonders of urban New Jersey with a tour through Newark. We speak to Frank Mentisana at Phillips Academy Public Charter School.
This idea of family style and made from scratch lunches continues to be a bit of an anomaly in the city.
We also hear from Gil Speyer from All Points West Distillery.
Newark used to have an incredibly rich beverage alcohol history.
And we'll tour Aero Farms, the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
We're growing using 390 times more productivity than field farming and 95% less water.
Tune in to this week's Meatin' 3 on Heritage Radio Network to be amazed at the wonders of Newark. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Dan Petrosky. We'll talk to Dan about the future cab, lark mead, wine, and a lot more. Dan brought in a lark mead, so we'll taste that for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right. Brooklyn-born, Dan Petrosky made his way uptown to Columbia University. Smart guy, right? Played a little football, headed down to NYU Biz School before moving into marketing, finance, and advertising at Time Inc. and Sports Illustrated. His love of wine through business, travel magazines, and a college friend with connections got Dan over to Sicily. Dan came back to the States, unemployed, made his way to Cali to follow his passion, and the rest fermented into a career in wine. Dan is the winemaker at Larkmead Vineyards in Calistoga and owns Massacan Winery in California. Dan was the 2017 Winemaker of the Year from the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Dan.
Thank you, Sam.
Welcome back in a way. We sat with you before, but this is a full one-on-one, so thank you for coming in.
No, I appreciate it, and you're little summary of my history is quite flattering.
Yeah,
and I don't think there's anything else to talk about.
Yeah. Good night, everyone. There is, though, Dan, and I want you to sort of take us further. I gave everyone a sense you're a New York boy, educated here, worked in business, but there was a point after you were successful in business that you kind of got this mini obsession with wine and you were looking forward towards it. And a friend of yours, I think in the business, knew wine people in Sicily and suggested that to you during another job offer. So let's talk about Dan from that point on and get me to today.
Sure, certainly. It was actually, having a friend in Sicily is a it's a pretty good thing. Especially when they have your back. But the way it actually happened was he did not suggest it to me. He advised me against it. So I'd hit my, I always jokingly say, I hit my midlife crisis. And, at Time Inc., I was there for 10 years and I was 33 years old. I had a conversation with my mother about the future and about working, and I'd be working for another 40 years, which was longer than I had lived at that point. So I had this opportunity to go work at the Wall Street Journal, and I had visited Sicily with my business school classmate Massimo Calafiore, and I fell in love with the culture, the people, the hospitality, and the generosity. And so when I was making a major career change, leaving a company that I thought I would never leave, Time Inc., to go to the Wall Street Journal, I said, is that a big enough change? And I woke up one morning and said, I'm going to move to Italy. And I called up Massimo, and he literally said, don't do it. He told me to go go work at the Wall Street Journal. But I pressed.
That was the easy move, though.
Yeah, that was the easy move. And I pressed, and he made some phone calls, and he called me back, and he said, "You're good to go. You know, don't embarrass me." And that was literally it. And that was in February 2005, and I had moved in June 1st, 2005.
So you get to Sicily. And you jump in and focus on wine. Tell me what happens when you get there and what you do.
Yeah, it was very nebulous. I didn't have a visa. I lived, and I don't know if they're going to come back and get me now. But I lived there in Europe illegally, technically, for a year. I was working with a family who owned a winery called Valle delle Catte. It was a split into a partnership between two families. One of the families managed the vineyards, and I spent about 3 days a week going to the vineyards with that family. And I was really, at the time, I was really learning, trying to learn the language a little bit, but then it's also learning Sicilian at that point, not even Italian, and really just experience my what it was to make wine. As you had hinted in the summary and the opening, I fell in love with wine as a wine drinker. I had zero idea about how wine was made. So for me to immerse myself with a family that owned a vineyard and made wine, it was an opportunity for me to kind of have a little bit more understanding. And, you know, my background is in sales and marketing, and that's storytelling. And if I can tell stories slightly better because I'm familiar with how those wines are made, I thought all the brand management jobs in the world for an Italian winery were going to be available to me. But when I got back to New York City a year later, they weren't. And that's what propelled me to California.
So clear something up for me. So when you were in Sicily, did you take everything in, you know, the cellar, the fields, or were you just plotting sort of on the brand management side or a little of everything?
It was a little bit of everything. I spent more time on the vineyard side because I was with the family that I was bumming around with. That was their role and responsibility. The winery was run by the other family, and they actually thought I was a bit of a spy.
That's funny.
It was very interesting. Every couple of years, they swapped who was the managing partner of the winery and so forth and so on. And it was a time in which the family I worked with was in the field. So for me, what I always say, my stock answer to that question usually is, I didn't learn how to make wine in Italy. I learned how to appreciate it.
Right.
The old world, as we know, has a different culture of wine consumption than we do here in America.
Pedestal, right?
Yeah, here in America, we're on a pedestal. In the old world, they're on the table. And, you know, wine is, to steal Richard Betts's famous phrase, wine is a condiment. And I think that is an old world philosophy. And it's something that we in America are growing and evolving to. We're not there yet.
Right. All right. So you said you come back from Sicily. You thought maybe you'd take all this experience going to brand management. Didn't happen. So take me to the path. I think you went to California, and let's get to the current from there.
Sure. No, I the second half of my stay in Sicily, I started reaching out to friends of friends who may or may not have known anyone in the wine industry, whether it be on the business side or in the winemaking side. And through the original connection at the Wall Street Journal, I met a gentleman in California, a young kid who started a winery with two of his friends called Anhill Farms. His name was Webster Marquez. And Webb, you know, expressed the same and delivered the same amount of hospitality and generosity with me as the Sicilians did. And he basically welcomed me into his home, put me up for a week in California and said, introduced me to his friends and said, let's, you know, you want to work out here? We'll figure it out. And through him and his connections, I was able to, and his business partner at Anhill Farms, David Lowe, introduced me to Andy Smith. And since I wasn't finding the job that I wanted on the marketing and sales side, the next opportunity for me was to continue this kind of winemaking journey and go from the vineyards and then straight into the cellars. And I ended up in Dumont in 2006 through the
great
connection.
Great Chardonnay and Pinot maker, right?
Oh, yeah. Andy was genius. I mean, he came up before the, you know, the Pinot movement in the mid-aughts, and he was in the late 90s, you know, and early 2000s. He worked with Ted Lemon at Litterai when Ted was based in Napa. And Andy had this consulting project called Larkmead, and he was kind of crafting Cabernets in Napa, and he was an owner, partner, winemaker at Dumont. And he was just, you know, he was in my opinion, this god, because he had his hands in, you know, multiple grape varieties, and he did every one of them well. One of the most talented, respected winemakers of his time. And I had this opportunity to work harvest for him and spend about 6 months with him. But it ended up being a lot longer, as he, at the end of harvest, he offered me a job.
So you took the job at Larkmead, and that was what year?
That was, I remember exactly the day he offered me the job, on Halloween 2006. It was still needed, the details needed to be worked out and the timing needed to be worked out, but effectively January 2007, I was full-time employed as a cellar master at Larkmead.
And now, 2019.
It's a long time.
It is. You are now the head winemaker. Andy recently left, right? He was there for a good part of your tenure.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Andy mentored me all the way through the late 2000s, promoted me all the way through from assistant to associate to winemaker at Larkmead in 2012. Andy went to focus on Dumas in 2013 and kind of left me with all his good graces and knowledge.
Right. So that's where Dan is right now. He's been at Larkmead for a while. For a minute or two later on, we'll talk about a side project of his Massacan. But I want to talk about Cabernet. I want to talk about Larkmead. There's a lot there. I got a chance to listen to you, I think it was about a year ago. I think we were all down at Blue Hill. And it was Raj Parr, Steve Mathiasen,
John Bonet,
and
Jason Wagner.
Jason Wagner from Union Square. And the talk was about the future of Cabernet Sauvignon. And it was kind of an interesting crew. And I wanted to talk to you about that because I guess my first question is, why are we questioning the future of Cabernet Sauvignon? I mean, why is that a topic?
I agree 100%, but I think when you have a monarchy and the king of all grapes is Cabernet, you always have to question the royalty and the regalness of it, and whether it's going to continue its path that way. And I wanted to start having intellectual conversations about wine in general and Cabernet Sauvignon because it's near and dear to my heart. But I wanted to do that because it ties back to Larkmead's history in the 1880s when a woman named Lily Hitchcock Coit founded Larkmead. A book was written about her and her mother's experiences in the Napa Valley called The Salon at Larkmead. And Lily had, you know, kind of cut her teeth in Paris and during the Civil War and came back to the United States into a rural northern California. And she would invite artists and writers over and have these intellectual salon-like evenings in Napa Valley. So I wanted to bring that back, almost kind of like a mini TED Talks conversation. And we've created quite a buzz. I mean, whenever I host these events at Larkmead, we do about three of them a year. We have a wait list. I mean, we only seat about 20, 25 people plus panelist and moderator, and so about 30 people in the room, and we have a wait list for people to get in because it's people want to have this conversation. And I think it's important as we see the change in consumption patterns, as we see the change in hospitality, as we see the development of the Napa Valley commercially, we are all thinking about why we're there, and that why we're there is Cabernet Sauvignon. It wasn't that way 50 years ago. Cabernet Sauvignon wasn't that grape that brought us there. It was just the idea of wine. But today it's Cabernet Sauvignon. It's the king. It always will be the king, as long as it has a future. And we're just going through the intellectual exercise of trying to figure out what that, you know, if how does that future change?
What are some of the concerns? I mean, what are issues? I mean, ten things are blasting in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, what are the things that come up frequently and concerns?
No, when we sat down in New York City a year ago with not only a star-studded panel, it was a star-studded room. I couldn't believe who came into the room that day. You know, all good people who've supported Napa Valley over the years, who may not be supporting it today, but still agree that when they cut their teeth in wine, they cut their teeth in, you know, wines like Napa Valley Cabernet or Bordeaux. And so I think what we're seeing today is, you know, what some of these topics have been style, have been price point? Are we, you know, stylistically moving away from...
Stylistically, it's been a very big, unctuous, high alcohol, right? Fair?
Fair. I mean, it's...
Price, it's always been expensive compared to other cab...
Fair. You know, I think those two, you know, I can sit here and tell you why the style is the style, why the price is the price. But at the end of the day, it's like it all works if wines sell. And wines, we've noticed in, from, you know, from the outside looking in from Napa Valley, that New York City is a hard place to sell wine these days because there's so much demand and diversity. There's so much demand for tradition and history and heritage. And at the same time, there's a lot of demand on price. Not everyone in New York City is, you know, fine dining, eating at fine dining restaurants or shopping at fine retail shops.
Right.
There's a mass consumption here. And so we're looking at it and asking ourselves the question, it's like, what are we able to think about the future? Are we just a niche in the grand scheme of things that has a massive brand awareness? Or, you know, I think if you are a niche, if you're a small producer and there is this massive Napa Valley brand awareness, you're going to ride that wave. But at the same time, you know, you see one less bottle sold each day and you ask yourself, people, why aren't we selling as much wine as we sold yesterday? And I think that question is, I'm not saying that's what's going on in Napa Valley today. I think we're selling more wine than ever.
Right.
Direct-to-consumer purchasing in the Napa Valley has been increasing every year.
But there are some changes. So what are the changes we're witnessing?
I mean,
I think you alluded to, and I think one of the big things is a change in the type of wine style.
Sure.
Restraint.
Sure.
I mean, is that a major thing where cab is going in Napa at least?
Yes, of course.
Tell people what restraint is in a Cabernet Sauvignon. What's the traditional thing, and you know what restraint means? I mean, three things come to mind to me, but I want to hear it from you.
I love it because, you know, I think about the golden age of Napa and when we started our kind of the Napa Valley started its peak rise, peak Cabernet moment in the mid-90s all the way up to the 2010s. We have a lot of sunshine in Napa Valley, so we can ripen fruit. I mean, the one thing Andy Smith told me when I arrived was everything ripens here. So we had the opportunity to make the fruit forward. Structured wines, powerful wines that maybe
no struggle towards that.
No struggle that Bordeaux struggles to make,
right.
And the Bordeaux is defined by its regionality and its weather patterns. You know, we're defined by our weather patterns on a completely different scale. And also, you know, I think the American consuming culture was consuming bigger and better things. They were consuming larger portions on the plate. They were consuming larger cars. They were consuming, you know, we went through an era in New York City dining where everything was big. You know, I had dinner, like everything was tall. Dishes
right.
were tall. There was foam. There was,
right.
Like you were making a statement. And I think Napa Valley Cabernet made that statement. And what's happening now is you see those families, you see those winemakers over time who own these properties have kind of went through that trend and that phase. And now they're taking a step back and thinking about what inspires them, what got them there in the first place, and how to make the wines that are respectful for their terroir and what they like to drink. And I think we're starting to see a lot of people in the Napa Valley. Some people never changed. Kathy Corson, perfect example, never changed.
But she started in a way that
she started,
was her conviction and is popular now.
It took a long time for Kathy to get popular.
Right. She didn't get the props vintage. When yeah. she was doing it.
25 vintages of Corson. I mean, it's a long time going.
Tell everyone what those things are. I mean, when you talk about the... benefit of, you know, great sunshine and, you know, having the opportunity to grow great fruit, you now take that fruit and what do? You over-extract it, you jack the alcohol, and you oak it? Was that a problem?
I think what happens is when you have a lot of great sunshine, you have ripe fruit, and ripe fruit means increased sugars, and increased sugars are going to mean increased alcohol potential, and increased alcohol potential is going to mean higher extraction, not only color and tannin, but also extraction of oak influence. When you have alcohol being that solvent, it's going to withdraw everything into it. So that was, you know, it was a spiral of just bigger and bigger and bigger and more extracted. And guess what? Those wines are delicious. I mean, right. You know, I mean,
they're a style and type of wine. Was there a Parkerization at that time? You know,
I think
he loved them and he was respected and people followed him.
Oh, I'm sure. But Bob was never embarrassed to tell you what he liked and what he enjoyed. Right. And if you didn't like what he the words he was writing and the wines he was supporting, then you found someone else who might. Or you went to Stephen Tanzer, and if you didn't enjoy Stephen Tanzer, you went to Jim Lauby. You had your opportunity and your choice to be guided down the path of wine, or hopefully you used your own palate. And that's right. I think the biggest part of this. And I think what's happening in the change now is we're starting to see more people coming out of this this era, this golden age, and starting to settle down with their own confidence and with their own palate, and starting to make the wines that they feel are that got them there in the first place. We're all inspired by the great wines of Europe. I mean, they've been doing it a lot longer than we have,
right.
And we need benchmarks. So,
is that a shift in the consumer? You know, I'm more of a baby boomer than you. You know, I cut my teeth in Napa caps. You know, now I'm auctioning them all to get Beaujolais and, you know, Italian wines and all that. Has there been a shift in that trophy collector? You know, is he still important, but new guys are coming in and they want a different style?
Of course.
Is that fueling it a little?
Of course. And you have to remember, too, we're 2 hours from Silicon Valley. So we are very close to the heart of the new money America. And I think we see that, you know, I think it's a little blown out of proportion when we think every, you know, 20-something millennial is a millionaire, a Twitter millionaire, or so right. forth and so on. But we do see, I've noticed this all the time. And you have to remember, I'm on the Larkmead property almost 6 or 7 days a week when I'm home in Napa Valley. And I see the faces who come through the door. And I see, you know, from 2006, 2007, when I started there to now, this current day, I see the faces get younger and younger and younger. And I'm excited about that. And it's they may not be buying the wines today, but they're exploring the Napa Valley and having the hospitality experience, having that emotional connection to what the wine industry has created, and, you know, in the Napa Valley and Sonoma County. And I think that is that's something that, you know, we're gonna hold on to for a very long time. And I think those visitors are gonna hold on to for a very long time as they right. kind of go down their own path. You said the journey of wine, I think, is your tagline here, the journey to great wine.
Yep. So let's talk about Larkmead a little. You know, we'll take the segue from talking about Cab to talking about Larkmead, which really is you and Larkmead are Cab specialists. The property is very interesting. I think you're lucky to be there. Tell everyone why the property is so special.
There are two to three reasons why I would consider Larkmead incredibly special. One is its location in the valley. So it's quote-unquote terroir. It is a unique family-held, three contiguous vineyards, entire valley floor spread between Silverado Trail and Highway 29 of unique soil diversity. And that is something that we don't see in the rest of the Napa Valley. Other as you get down to the wider parts of the Napa Valley, down into St. Helena, Rutherford, Oakville, etc., as you go south, they tend to be a little bit more homogenized swaths of land. Larkmead is completely diverse within its own right, and it's cut in half by a river, the Napa River. So as any good winemaker is going to tell you, or any good vigneron is going to tell you, the land is number one. And I'd be remiss to say it wasn't.
So it's large, contiguous, and diverse.
And diverse. So that's number
Which, like you said, I mean, there's a swath on the yeah. floor, and that's it. Rutherford dust, see you later.
Yeah.
This is, you know, a lot more diverse, right?
That is absolutely true. And then two is you know, we have a family who's owned Larkmead since 1948. The second generation daughter, Kate Solari Baker, her and her husband, Cam Baker, decided in 1992 when they took over Larkmead that they were going to give it a go. They were gonna replant the vineyard, which was planted to over 60 acres of white grapes at the time, oof. To red grape varieties during this era of.
Well, you kind of like white grapes, but separate story. Go ahead.
No, but we had great collaborators and partners. We were selling all of our whites.
Don't
to,
get
to,
off
to Chapelet and to
stay on topic.
But they decided to replant the entire vineyard to a mix of red grape varieties, with Bordeaux varieties being a focus. And as we've learned over the years, you know, not only for supply and demand issues, Cabernet Sauvignon does very well in the Napa Valley, especially the hotter, warmer, drier part of the north of Napa Valley where Larkmead's located. So you have this great piece of land, and you have this family who decides to actually, you know, kind of be stewards of that place, and decides to kind of, you know, give it a go. And change, you know, take their former careers as a lawyer and a painter, and really kind of say, all right, we're gonna test this out. And I think that unwavering kind of a commitment to figuring it out from a second generation family in Napa Valley has been one of the special reasons.
So they had Andy at their side, which was the right guy.
Yeah.
Then they paired you with Andy, or Andy brought you along. So they had a good team in that sense. So now you're making the wines, as we talked about earlier, about style. You know, the grapes in Napa can take advantage of the heat and the sunshine, high sugar. But what's your approach to the wines there? You make multiple bottlings, but you're not necessarily going out there making these big bombers.
No, and it's, you know, I think we definitely are in the category of Napa Valley style. When Larkmead started making wine in the late 90s, 1997 was the first commercial vintage. This is a property that is 124 years old as an estate, as a vineyard, but it's only really modern winemaking since 1997. So we're still kind of young to the game. So we've kind of went through the ebbs and flows of, you know, the big flavor era, the high impact era, you know, in the early 2000s, and then the big flavor in the late 2000s. And then, you know, as I kind of, you know, had confidence in myself and confidence in, you know, working with a viticultural team that was, you know, as committed and as smarter than the rest, I said, you know, we really need to be able to express what this vineyard does best. If this vineyard is large and it's contiguous and it is diverse, we should be respectful of that and not try to homogenize style to be a Napa Valley wine, but to be important to understand why we're diverse and how we can express that in a glass. And a lot of that is, you know, I use this example over and over again because it's a really good one. But if you play music at the highest volume, the noise, the music, the listening gets distorted, and you start to kind of get a little bit of a fuzziness to it and a distortion that removes a lot of the nuance to the song. That was just a simple thing about, you asked about it earlier, about what makes a big wine. And so you remove a little bit of the alcohol, like you remove a little bit of the volume on a record player, and you're going to remove a little bit of that extraction. So you're not going to have as big of fruit extraction, you're not going to have as big as color extraction or tannin or oak extraction, and you're not going to be masking what lies underneath. Well, guess what? If what lies underneath is shit, then you got shit.
Dead.
Then you better put the volume up really loud.
Right.
But if you can't, if you're not a good guitarist, you better play as loud as you possibly can. But for me, Larkmead is great. Like the soils, the ground, the team that farms that vineyard is great. And it's an opportunity now to kind of, you know, lower the volume, lower a little bit of the alcohol, and see how good this is. And I've been shocked to see, you know, the changes in, as you get into the current vintages, the 16s, the 17s, the 18s, how you remove a slight percentage point of alcohol, and how the wine still remains powerful but much more interesting. And it's just the nature of the land, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. And I bet
you're
still
figuring it out.
Yeah, if I go too low on the volume, you're not going to be able to hear the nuances either. So I need to figure out what the right balance is.
Well, the interesting thing is, before we take a break, I'll ask you this one question. Then when we come back, a few more questions, I'll subject you to our wine list, and we'll taste some of the Larkmead. You're not one of those guys, and we talked about it a little, UC Davis, you know, winemaking a million years. And, you know, everything you're saying is, you know, right and sensible, and you're learning on the job. You've discovered things, you've figured out things and all that. But your background hardcore is not as a winemaker. So how do you figure all this shit out?
I'm a wine drinker. I've always been a wine drinker.
What does that mean? So you know what you want, or you can identify?
I have a hard time explaining this to people. I always say the wine is made in my head and my heart and my palate. The actual physical act of growing grapes, fermenting grape juice, taking it off its must, putting it into barrel, aging it, and putting it under cork in a bottle is purely manufacturing. I don't want to break anyone's romantic view of what the wine process is, but the romantic view of wine is what's in our head and hearts and palate. Things that we aspire to, things that we love, things that we enjoy tasting, we find delicious. That's what winemaking is to me, and it will always be. It's not in a textbook. It's not in a fermentation vessel. It's not in an oak barrel. All of those components are part of the production process that are the colors, the pencils, the pens that paint the picture. And that, I think, is if you drink enough, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory way, if you drink enough around the world and you find out what you're looking for and what you like, and you're good at being able to replicate, you're going to be able to kind of see how weather, how fermentation, how oak influences the finished product, and hopefully be able to shape it to your vision and to your what's in your head and heart and palate.
So to me, that sounds easier said than done. But the doing you're saying is not that hard. You just really have to know and have the conviction of what you want to do and what you like, right? I mean, you have people around you to help you, and the process is the process to some extent, yeah. Right?
Every bottle of wine in this world is delicious to someone. I can find positives and negatives in every bottle of wine. The negatives I find in any bottle of wine are going to be my own subjective approach of being a wine snob. But it's delicious to everyone. I mean, I'm not going to tell any one person, any maker of wine, that they didn't make a delicious wine. That what they made is what they believed was the best representation of what they put under cork. And guess what? Everyone is making delicious wines in California, in France, in Italy. They're all over the place.
I agree.
You can't go wrong. It's just what you're comfortable with as a drinker and what you're comfortable with in your wallet.
I agree. Dan, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Dan Petrosky. Dan is the winemaker at Lark Mead Vineyards and Massacon, his own project. When we come back, I want to talk to him about a few other things about his wine in Napa. And then we'll subject him to our wine list and we'll taste a little Lark Mead. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Serchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
All right, we're back with my guest, Dan Petrosky. Dan is the winemaker at Lark Mead in Napa Valley and his own project, Massacon. I wanted to get your take on this. sustainable, organic, biodynamic practices in the field and the cellar, somewhat essential to our future. My observations, and correct me if I'm wrong, is Napa's not the best practitioner of those things. What are you doing? What do you see? What should we do? I mean, I know you take a holistic approach. You have a Napa Green rating, which you'll explain. But tell me, because you go to the Loire, you know, Italy, it's the opposite.
Now, actually, Sam, that's not factually correct. I'm going to fact
good,
check.
So
I'm going to fact check you on that one.
That's why I brought it.
There's only about 6% of the world's vineyards that are organically farmed. In Napa Valley, we're above average. We're about 9%.
Okay.
So that's first and foremost.
Right, let me challenge you. But that's a declaration. There are people that practice that don't declare.
Sure, just like Larkmead. Larkmead practices, we've been organically farming since 2015, but we do not declare. We do not put ourselves through the certification process. Harlan, probably one of the most famous wineries in the world. Same situation. So we have that same scale on both sides. I agree with you 100%. A lot of the European wineries that don't declare are also at the same situation where they're saying, I live on this property, I farm this property myself. The health and wellness benefits are in organic farming and sustainable agriculture, of course. But on paper, we can only go with what we know factually, unfortunately.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we're, you know, the people who don't farm organically are bad people. The wines are still delicious. I think the wines are still healthy. A lot of wines that are made, quote unquote, unnaturally, are still grapes, water, sugar.
I'm not alcohol. Implying that. I'm just
and there's still a tremendous amount of deliciousness in those wines, and just because they're at the end of the day, a lot of the vineyards in this world that we drink wine from are not owned by families and farmed by families and made by that family. They're grapes purchased from farmers, and farmers can tell them how to farm, but we can't tell them, you know, we have to pay for it.
Right.
And so.
So wait, go back to 2015.
Yeah.
Obviously, there was a compulsion.
Yeah.
At that time or leading up to it.
Yeah.
That you made the changes. You know, why and what did you do?
Yeah. No, I just think that, you know, there's the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but you have this situation where people are doing what people around them are doing. And so you just continue to do your practice that has been brought to you by, you know, the farming companies you've worked with or the vineyard management teams that you have in-house. It's what they know what they how to do best, and you have to make a change. And when you make that change, sometimes it's pretty drastic and pretty scary, and you go from having to do weed control with one pass of Roundup to having to do weed control five or six times
right.
in the field. That comes with an expense associated with it. It comes also with that conversation about, oh, is that carbon friendly to be doing five tractor passes as opposed to one? You know, better living through science. I agree with that statement when you're on your deathbed, but can we sustainably live healthier lives longer? And I think that was the bigger question when Larkmead decided to think about organic farming. We started to think about vine age and health of soil and how it will translate to older, healthier vines. Older, healthier vines over a course of time are going to be more financially efficient. So thinking of it as a business.
Right. And it's such a large property and it's so diverse, but still. You know, you're a practitioner of many varietals, but at Larkmead, you know, it's fairly singular. I guess two questions. Do you see Napa spreading out from Cabernet Sauvignon, or it's happening already? And what about Larkmead?
Sure.
I know from my research, there's a little, I think, was Tokaj or Rebola, you know.
Yeah,
where is that noble grape spreading out a little, or?
Yes. I do think that, you know, it's hard to say you're a monoculture and when you're only 110 acres. You can be a monoculture on a 110 acre footprint, but at the same time, I don't think anyone's going to fault you for having 110 acres of great Cabernet Sauvignon.
No.
And as a winemaker, I've decided in the last 5 years to eliminate secondary and tertiary varieties in the Bordeaux family, like Petit Verdot and Malbec, from the wines we're making. And I did that over time, slowly over time. We started to remove Petit Verdot and Malbec. We removed in 2015.
Why?
Because
didn't like the blend.
Malbec and Petit Verdot were like salt and pepper. It was an opportunity for us to kind of fill in some gaps in the painting and the holes in the painting if we needed to, with different flavor profiles that were in the same family. And I said, well, we want to be able to make great wines. You want to make a great painting with one grape variety, Cabernet Sauvignon or Merlot or Cabernet Franc, and let's blend those together as opposed to having 4 or 5 varieties that we work with. So we have less Petit Verdot and Malbec planted on the site than we did when I started 13 years ago, 14 years ago. And we now only work with 3 grape varieties because they are the 3 great grape varieties of the red family and Cabernet Franc.
And you said to be recognized as one of the great winemakers of the world, you have to work with one of the noble varieties. And fortunately for you, we all agree, Cab Sauv is one of them.
It's true.
And Larkmead certainly is deeply focused, you know, on that. And like you said, you just made tweaks. You got rid of Malbec and Petit Verdot and all of that. You still believe that?
Of course. The great winemakers of the world are going to be the winemakers who succeed phenomenally well and are popular brand perception and with grapes like Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc. I mean, and I can tell, you know, half a dozen great, you know, Loire Valley producers making Sauvignon Blanc. I can tell dozens of Pinot producers, dozens and dozens and dozens of Cabernet producers. But that's where, you know, that's the big leagues. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. It's the big leagues.
Except for Burgundy. I mean, you know, Burgundy has been hot for the last 10 years, but Bordeaux ruled in Napa. You know,
I'm putting Burgundy in the big leagues. It's like we're the majors, and when you start talking about, you know, secondary, tertiary places of this world and regions and varieties you never heard of, and they're hard to they're fun for exploration, they're fun for tasting and having a good time, but at the end of the day, they're still double and triple A.
So quickly, you have limited, and not negative in the word limited, but at Larkmead, you have limited offerings. I mean, you have literally less than a half a dozen SKUs of red, right? I mean, let's talk about them. We're going to taste in a few minutes, you know, the Cabernet, and then you have some named bottlings. Just take me through them quickly.
Sure. No, and I think that's actually a very, very interesting question, because when you think about what we're making 6 wines at a singular property because we're exploiting the diversity that's on the land. But that's the antithesis of the Napa Valley, you know, desire to be this chateau model of Bordeaux, where you have a singular great wine. And the Napa Valley was built on singular great wines like Harlan, as you mentioned earlier, and Dominus,
Schaefer,
and Opus One, and you know, Spotswood. And these are singular wines from a singular estate. And Larkmead chose recently to explore 6 wines from a singular estate with 6 different expressions of the land and the grape varieties that make it up. And I think that is actually a little bit that's challenging. You know, when a drinker of Cabernet Sauvignon thinks of a singular great wine, and now they have to make a choice at Larkmead. And so that's why we succeed really well with having, you know, our hospitality experience is over an hour and a half.
But I think with that property, you're pushed to that challenge.
It is. And
you know, why not take advantage and expand and, you know, express the terroirs of the property, right?
And I wouldn't, look, I'm not saying I'm a great winemaker, but I wouldn't put a bottle wine in a bottle for a marketing reason. If it wasn't a complete wine from my perspective, I would not bottle it. That's just unacceptable. And from my perspective as a wine drinker and as a maker. So, you know, we have this ability to do exactly what you said, is to exploit.
Right.
And that is truly, that is a blessing. And it's gives me an opportunity to do things that a lot of other people
Which for Napa is a little unique because of the names we discussed. You know, the Harlins make their wines from that property in Spotswood. I mean, it's a very cool thing. We're going to taste the Larkmead, and we'll talk a little more about it. But I can't let you leave here without subjecting you to our wine list, and we're always very curious about our guests' preferences and tastes. So I'm going to shoot five questions at you. Don't obsess on them. And just give me your best answer. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Not the beer and the lark mead, but what's on your table? What's in your fridge? What are you obsessing on?
Right at this moment, it's champagne is always in the refrigerator.
Okay.
Beer is always in the refrigerator.
Do you have a favorite too on champagne?
Oh,
you move around a lot?
I have a very expensive champagne budget and habit, unfortunately.
Solos?
No, I have a little bit more classic styles. I really do like Clos de Gauze when I can get my hands on it. But Cedric Bouchard, is kind of a someone I've been following since 2006, and he's not gone out of fashion for me, so I drink a lot of those wines.
Why do you like champagne? I mean, I love it. I go to dinner with my friends. They bring wine. I always bring champagne. It's a great opener. It's great with food. It's celebratory. I mean, you agree with me? What other reasons?
Oh,
it's one of the great wines.
It's a great wine, but I think it actually, not to get into the psychology of it so much, but what I do think is that we're a beer-consuming culture, and beer is about carbonation and freshness and low alcohol. Champagne's about carbonation and freshness and low alcohol. It's a starter. Beer has always been the after
Good
work.
Good point. I mean, that word aperitif. Starter is a great,
yeah.
I like starter better than celebratory. Anything else? So you said beer, champagne, anything on the wine front?
Champagne is wine.
No, I know, but I meant non-sparkling.
Oh, no, it's wine. Wine for me is like I'm getting back into Bordeaux in a heavy way because I started my, drinking Bordeaux in the late 90s in New York City and early 2000s, and I've started to realize how beautiful those expressions are, and I'm now getting back to a point where I can spend some more time as a producer thinking about those wines and not just a wine consumer.
Nice. This is the goofiest question of the bunch, but does Dan Petrosky have a favorite wine and food pairing? And we have a rule on the show. You can't say champagne and oysters.
Champagne and popcorn?
You know what?
Champagne.
You're not the first guy who said that, and that's a good one. Champagne fried chicken, champagne pizza. So champagne popcorn is a good one. Give me one more.
I'm huge on drinking white wine with dishes that you're not supposed to drink white wine with, whether it be, lamb or venison or...
But we're not throwing caution to the wind. We're picking specific whites to go with a lamb, right?
Oh, I mean, you mentioned Tokaj Filano as a grape variety, a heritage Italian grape variety. It's planted
with
lark
lamb.
Mead. It's great with, you got to remember that's a northeast Italian grape, and it's a region that's very Germanic. So it's great with heavier, richer dishes.
Cool. All right, so that's a good answer. Tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. And I'm looking for places that do it well, have a good selection, have a good wine knowledge, that are passionate. You can go anywhere. You can go to New York. You can go Napa. You can go in the world. And I don't want you to be exclusive, like, oh, I left this guy out or whatever. But just, drop a couple of things that people that are doing it well.
Eating and drinking is the one thing I'd love to do. And we're blessed in Napa Valley to have a tremendous resource of great wine. Drinking restaurants, and if I named one, I'd have to name them all. But since we're sitting in here in New York, I'm going to focus on New York for a second.
That'd be good.
I started my career in Italy, and my palate's always been in a love of Italian wines. And Maialino's is just hands down it gets me really warm and excited when I flip through the pages of that wine list. I just want
to drink a boatload of champagne too.
Champagne and Nebbiolo. I want to be.
Give
around
me one
it all
more.
Day. and then it's funny. I grew up in as an Italian American in Brooklyn, and we went to the far Bay Ridge to Bensonhurst area to an old restaurant called Tommaso's, and that restaurant is known in kind of this. I just let the cat out of the bag. It's got an amazing wine list from the last 30 plus years of collecting and
really
and
you let the
great,
cat out of the bag.
A great red sauce joint and a wine list that is priced effectively.
That's a good one. Do you have a favorite all-time wine? And I realized through the years we've been doing this that sometimes it's not just one, and it's definitely not the rarest or the most expensive. It could be experiential. But when you think about a wine, that you loved or is important to you. Does anything come to mind?
There's many wines that I have a Desert Island wine. I have the wine that got me into wine. I have the wine that inspires me.
All right, so I want all three. Give me the Desert Island wine.
Giuseppe Mascarello Man Privato.
Okay, love that. Give me the, what'd you say, inspires you?
Obrion,
okay, there's your cab. And what was the last category you were throwing in?
The wine that got me into wine was Sean Thackeray's Pleiades.
I remember reading that.
Story. It's a blend, wine, right? About storage. Seven grapes, seven sisters, grapes. Yep. Had it at La Bernardin, speaking of New York City.
That's funny that they had it. Still an interesting wine. All right. Maybe a little tougher for you, but we ask everyone, best wine around $15, $15-$20 retail, a red and a white. You can go category like Muscadet, you can go with a maker, you can go with a varietal or whatever. What comes to your mind? And my setup's always been, my kids are in their 20s. They can't bring a crappy $8 wine to a party, and they can't afford 40. So what are they grabbing for 20?
No, I'm sorry I'm dating myself on this one, but I don't know what their current price points are. But I, on both white and red, I used to always tell my sisters who asked me about wine when I lived in California, and my mother who asked me about wine when they were going shopping for dinner or having an event, I said, buy La Crema. La Crema is a large winery making wine like a small winery.
That's a good answer. Yeah. Good maker, good price point, good reputation. Yeah. So La Crema, Pinot and Chards?
Pinot and Chardonnay.
So does that answer both questions?
That's my go-to $20 wine. You might get a comment that it actually wines are now $24 a bottle.
You know, you got the cred to throw that out there, and I think it's a great answer. So, you know, we didn't have to spend much time on that. All right, Dan, we got to wrap up. But before we wrap up, every week we taste a different wine on air. I try to get my guests to bring in wine. Obviously, for our weekly wine sip this week, I asked Dan to bring in a Larkmead Cabernet Sauvignon. It's a 2016. I think it's their, you know, regular Cabernet. Just give me a little quick background on this, and then we're going to evaluate it and taste it.
Oh, sure. No, this is Larkmead. This is the wine that if you've ever come across Larkmead, it's probably this wine. It is the wine that we make the most of. It's almost 30% of their entire production. It is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon grapes grown on the entire three contiguous vineyard estate. It also has a little bit of, in this particular vintage, a little bit of Petit Verdot in there as well. Again, we didn't stop using that until 2016. It's the wine that we have to, as Andy Smith told me, we have to make it our best wine every year because it is our largest production wine. It is the wine that you'll have at a restaurant in New York.
It's the touch point for the vineyard to the most people.
Yeah, and this the reason why these wines are so special to me, it's 2015 Cabernet, 2016 Cabernet, which we're drinking today, they're so special to me is because a lot of what goes into this this finished wine, this bottle, are grapes that were grown during the time I've been at Larkmead. So it's a very young wine with regards to the vine age, but at the same time, it shows its pedigree of land and quality. Of grape growing on that land for the last 120 plus years.
All right, so let's give it a sniff, and then we're going to throw it over the tongue. But first, color, that classic deep red. But there's a little translucent in there. It's not that inky dark, right?
No, it's 2016. It's a vintage, a little higher than average yields, a little cooler than average temperatures, which made the wines a little less darker and inkier.
Beautiful color, though. All right. I need you to do this because I suck at it. What's our descriptors on the nose?
Sam, I suck at it, too.
Tell me what you get.
I'm very bad at this.
Is it classic? I mean, are we looking at dark fruits? Are we looking at...
No, Larkmead is known in my eyes for being very floral.
Okay, so the aromatics lean towards floral.
They lean closer to red and blue fruits than to blue and black fruits. So when you think of a red and blue fruit, you go from cherries to raspberries to blueberries, as opposed to blackberries and darker plum notes. And I also love that Larkmead has some such great diversity of soil that causes a lot of stress, and that stress causes a little bit of a kind of secondary and tertiary notes of herbaceousness.
All right, so Let's throw it over the tongue and talk about two things: mouthfeel, and then I want to see what you get on the palate, if it, you know, equates to the nose. So here we go, over the tongue. So I'll go first. It's not this big, unctuous, glycerin-y wine that you get from Napa. What is it, a medium palate? Give me your...
Yeah, I have a lot of great sommelier friends who can speak to the mediums, medium plus weight,
medium
mid palate.
Right.
But for me, this wine, Signature Lark Meat, is about freshness. It's about a wine that, to your point, it's not over the top, but it's a viscosity and richness and weight. It doesn't die on the palate. It's more Muhammad Ali than it is George Foreman. They're both heavyweights, but Ali floats like a butterfly. Lark Meat has always been ethereal. And it has always kind of left the palate in a retro nasal way.
So let's talk about the palate. What do we get on the palate? Does the nose transfer to the palate? The blue and red fruits?
This is a perfect example of the nose carrying over through to the palate. You do have a lot of kind of dusty red red cherry on the tannins and kind of a pillbox character to the, you know, the tannins. And it's just, you know, all those kind of mid-palate, core mid-palate, you know, red and blue fruit.
What's the great, our buddy Kirk Sutherland's coming in to share a glass with us. What are the great pairings for a wine like this?
I love this because it's not just a steak and Cabernet kind of wine. I think this is a wine that has the ability to kind of be versatile on a table because of its agility and nimbleness.
What else?
So you can have it with lamb, you can have it with chicken, you can have it with... I wouldn't recommend it with fish.
Okay.
I don't recommend a lot of red wine with fish.
All right. Are you happy with this wine, 16, and the way it came out? I mean, this wasn't a tough year. This was a good wine, good year.
It was a great year. I'm so happy with the quality of this wine. I really feel this is where I was the first vintager I was able to. You and I had been making the wine since 2012, 13. This is the first vintager I feel the wines are just truly
really
my stamp.
All right, so that is the 2016 Lark Mead Cabernet Sauvignon. Our buddy Kirk Sutherland, who is the wine director at Roberta's, just walked in, and a friend of Dan's, and he's going to taste and tell us what he thinks. But I got to wrap up the show. You got here late, Kirk. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. I know it's confusing, but pay attention. Also, subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. I will post Dan's wine list on our social media. I will post Dan's weekly wine sip. I'll give you more information on the wine. And Dan, where can we find more info on Lark Mead? Just go to the website.
Go to the website and come visit. I think you'll
right.
learn the most.
You'll learn the good most hospitality.
You'll learn the most when you come see us.
And what about you? If people want to know what Dan's eating and drinking and what he wears, your personal
no selfies. I just have a pretty lame bottle shot Instagram account that I post.
And that's
once
at Dan Petrosky, right?
Yeah, Dan Petrosky on Instagram.
All right, and I just want to say that Dan is beyond, you know, the winemaker at Lark Mead. Dan has his own project called Massican, and he's very focused on Northern Italian white wines, and he's doing some great stuff there. And that's another show on its own. Dan also is obsessed with anything liquid, so he's screwing around with beer. He's screwing around with gin. He would like to do something with water. So down the road, we'll sit down and, you know, talk to everybody about that. Fair enough, Dan?
That's true. I love...
All right. Before we go off, Kirk, can you just take a sniff and a sip? And this is not the traditional Roberta's wine, but give me your take on this.
You know, it's benchmark Napa Cabernet.
But not over the top, right?
Yeah. This is the kind of Napa Cabernet that should be more celebrated and sought after.
I agree with you on that.
We had Lark Mead on the list over at Blanca because it's something that we know people want to have with their meals, but we want something that has a bit more elegance and won't overpower
right.
food and will actually complement things. And I find the Larkmead wines to be.
That's a great way to put it. And Dan, that's why we had you on the show, because you're doing some great things out there. I want to thank our guest, Dan Petrosky. I want to thank Kirk Sutherland for running in here. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.